The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Sandra Shea. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. You know what I'm going to say first, which is please turn off your cell phones or silence them. I also want to remind you that there's a book signing that will take place upstairs in the lobby following tonight's event. And if your experience of the Free Library is limited to this great author series that they have, I encourage you to check out everything else the library offers. For example, they have through June upstairs, the Central's rare book department is mounting an exhibit of vintage movie posters called Foyer Entertainment, movie lobby cards from 1930s to 1960s. It's from the library's theater collection, and the library itself is well worth supporting. I've done it for years, and even if you support it the way I do, which is usually paying a lot in overdue fines, I encourage you to support the library. So by way of introduction, I'm the editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Daily News. I cover policy, legislation, education, and city planning issues. I have an MFA in fiction and literature. I've published a novel and some short stories. So in other words, you can't get more serious or self-important than me. Why are you laughing? I knew you would be interested in how someone gets to be as serious and important as I am. So I thought a lot about my earlier influences. I was reading my brother's copies of Ramparts magazines when I was 11, and The Village Voice, and Mother Jones, and all the other radical journalism I could get my hands on. But my literary influences go back further than that. Probably to the most radical periodical of the 20th century, Mad Magazine. Soon after, I graduated to another radical journal, National Lampoon, and I'd always turn first to the comics pages, especially to look for Trots and Bonnie, which was a cartoon written by Linda Flinnikin. Those pages were not just my training in the subversive. They were the beginning of a golden age of comics, which led to a golden age of the graphic novel or the graphic memoir. And the best in this class was, and always has been, Linda Barry. I have a shelf of her books, starting with Boys and Girls, which was published in 1986. A lot of you probably weren't born then. And collections from her long-running syndicated Ernie Pook's comics. Her work contains a universe of heartbreaking truths about being small in a big world, about friendship and betrayal, love and dancing, and the weird and smelly mysteries of grown-ups. And when you step back to analyze the power of a graphic story, it's hard to distinguish between the pictures and the words, because both are the story, after all. And as much as I love Barry's drawings, her words get inside my head, like the words of the best writers I know. Her writing manages to be both full and full of economy, like the best poetry. I'm going to indulge you all for a minute and read four frames that she wrote, I think in probably 1989, and it's called This Vase. It was windy and pouring rain the afternoon of Friday, our art period, the hardest rain you ever saw. You know when you sit there at your desk and it's like tons of BBs are just pounding off the windows? We were on clay, the coil method. Everyone was rolling out their million little snakes, curling them around and around on top of each other. And the record player was going, what was that song, that one art period song? Even with the lights on, our room was dark and all the desks were ganged up together and I kept staring at my hands on the clay, going back and forth, like a pure hypnotizer. I was rolling the clay when my teacher bent down and put her warm hand on my shoulder and I didn't stop. You know how something can feel so perfect you can't even blink? That was the day I made this vase for you. kills me. And she has been writing like that for so many years. Like the best writers, Barry's work is a constant conversation between questions and answers, mysteries and truth, between the intimate and the universal. In 2008, she published What It Is, one of the best writing guides I've ever seen, and which, if it had come out 5 years earlier, probably would have saved me $20,000 getting that MFA. That book got a 2009 Eisner Award. Her workshop, called Writing the Unthinkable, is constantly sold out. And her new book, Picture This, features the return of Marlis and the introduction of a new character, the nearsighted monkey. In it, Barry explores the question of why we stop drawing and why we start. And she's going to talk about that tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the artist, novelist, playwright, and genius, Linda Barry.
Oh, hello, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. I am so happy to be in Philadelphia. I love Philadelphia. If I was a city and cities could make out with other cities, I would totally make out with Philadelphia and try to go steady with Philadelphia. I love Philadelphia for a number of reasons, but in the last few years, Philadelphia has become very close to my heart because I've been kind of teaching in odd little places in Philadelphia. I have a friend who's making a film about the way that I teach, and she lives nearby, and I said, okay, we can do the film if you'll figure out odd places for me to teach. Because I'm really interested in this idea. We're going to talk about drawing tonight, but drawing and writing and music and everything we call the arts have something in common, and it's not aesthetics. It's something that I call an image. And it was interesting to teach it to people who were interested in writing or to teach this stuff, but I wanted to see if I could be in situations where people weren't interested in writing and if they still wanted to do it. So my friend arranged for me to teach in prison here, in a medium security prison, which I was like, all right, man, I go to prison. It's going to be really great, you know? And then you go in and you have to take all this stuff off and they start walking you through these different like dog kennel-y things where you have to go in and the door closes behind you and then there's a door in front of you and you kind of go in deeper and deeper into the prison, you know, and you're just like going, all right, I'm tough. And after a while you go, I'm not that tough. And then, but what I loved is as we were walking in and had to get patted down, we were on the outside and I can't remember the name of the prison, but it's a really old one. I taught there twice. The kind that when I Googled it, it looks like a spider with 10 legs and it was built turn of the century. So the guys are really on the cell block. They can like see you, right? And they started yelling stuff like, hey, luscious, lovely, luscious. I mean, they yelled other stuff, but I'm just giving you the G-rated, luscious. And the guard was really sorry and he's like, I'm so sorry. I said, man, I'm 55 years old. Men have not screamed at me like that in a really long time. And it's very hard to scream luscious. Luscious! So I already liked them. And when we got into the room where I was going to teach the second time I was there, it's like this, there's things about prison that you can figure out and things you can't figure out. Like, we go into this room and all the chairs are bolted to the ground and the tables are all bolted to the ground and everything's round. There's no edges, no hard edges on anything. And in fact, when we brought pens and notebooks for the people, we couldn't bring ones with spirals on it because I guess you can turn that into, I don't know, what, a ninja star or something. And so so it was just wild to be there. And the guard said to me, do you want me to be in the room or out of the room? And I said, out. Because I'm looking at all the dudes, you know, shaved heads, little teardrop things and stuff. And I think, out. And he goes, so when I'm out there, the door's going to be locked. You can't get out. And I was like, but I looked at them, and they're all kind of young guys. And I'm like, I have to tell, and I may talk about menopause and how fantastic it is tonight. Because the thing to know is that once you hit it, there's something that changes. And when you're in a room with guys who are all under the age of 35, you're the ante. You're Auntie Linda, right? Immediately. And so I knew it wasn't going to be a problem, and it wasn't. But what was amazing to me is to hear these people in a situation using images and writing in this way. Here's what I think about images, right quick. I asked, remember when you were a kid and you'd lay in bed and you somehow thought that you got to pick between three superpowers? Do you want it? Would you rather fly, turn invisible, or time travel? Like somebody's going to let you, right? Like somebody's going to do this. I have to set my timer so I don't talk my head off at you. Hold it, sorry, because otherwise I will. All night and you'll try to. I was at a film festival once that the film festival was that you didn't have to pay to get in, but you had to pay to get out. And they showed the, it was a fundraiser, and they showed horrible movies, and the sooner you wanted to get out, the more you had to pay. So it's been free tonight so far, right? Anyway, I forgot what I was saying before that, but that's, does anybody remember what I was saying before that? Prison, yes, prison. Rock. Superpowers, that's it. Superpowers. So you're laying in bed, and you know if you say to a kid, would you like to fly or turn invisible or time travel, kids will go, yeah. If you say it to an adult, they'll be like, only if I can make a living from it. But this thing of, I asked kids that. I say, what would you pick? And my nephew said this amazing thing. He said, I want a time travel, but I want a time machine that has future, past, and meanwhile. The meanwhile knob, right? And that's what I think images do. I think part of it is, in the same way when you're reading a really good book, but you're at the Jiffy Lube in the waiting room, you're in two places at once, right? You're at the Jiffy Lube in the waiting room waiting for them to change your oil, and you're also in Russia, turn of the century. So that's one of the things I think images do. But, okay, yes, and I was excited to tell you that, and also I just want to tell you as a representative of Wisconsin and the big protests that we've been having, the cheese does not stand alone. That was my sign when I went around. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit. If you've heard me talk before, I'm going to say probably a couple of things that you've probably heard before, but it's easy to set it up. And I want to talk a little bit about this thing of what an image is. And the fastest way I can explain it is by asking you if you can remember your first phone number, because I'm going to count to three and we're going to say our first phone number out loud, okay? 1, 2, 3. PA24435. Nice. Let's do it one more time. 1, 2, 3. PA24435. Okay, now your phone number from another phone, from three phone numbers ago. Do you feel the difference? If we were doing a functional MRI on your brain, right when you were thinking of those two phone numbers, you'd see one thing. That first phone number would actually activate much more of your brain than you trying to figure out what that phone number was from three phone numbers ago. And you know how I've never seen anybody say their first phone number without doing this afterwards? You know, didn't you just do it? You said your first phone number and you were like, what the hell is that? Like, social security number, first phone number. So the first phone number is an image. So an image feels somehow alive. And my idea is that, well, it's not my idea. I learned it from my teacher, Marilyn Frasca, but at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington was a hippie school, and that you could get into at the time by just taking an index card, Elmer's glue, peace sign, lentils, full scholarship. Her idea was that the arts are like a container. Everything we call the arts contains this thing she calls an image. And I would say that all the toys that kids get very, very attached to also contain an image. And I love to watch kids because I really am interested in what objects. They're always carrying something around. I saw a kid in an airport who he had the whole Incredible Hulk doll, but when I saw him, all he had left was the leg. It's like, the leg's all I need, man, you know. And I'm going to go back to this idea about kids and images. What's interesting about these objects is that they contain something, whatever it is, that's going to make the difference of whether that kid's able to sleep that night or not. If you've ever been around a kid who's lost their object, it's really it's a really, really big deal. This is a story I often tell, but if you've heard it, I'm sorry, but I just want to tell it again because it's so good. It's about Mr. Banana. It was like I had some friends who had a little girl who got really attached to a horrifyingly ugly stuffed banana, like with big blue eyes and little dangling black arms, right? She loved Mr. Banana so much, and no one gets to pick what they get attached to. And so she's in there like, oh God, Mr. Banana. And by the age of three, Mr. Banana's looking pretty gnarly. You know, he's barely a banana. He looks more like an avocado of some sort. And they really want her to start to wean off of her relationship with Mr. Banana. And so they're in England, and they decide they're going to go for a walk. And they get downstairs to go up, and she realizes she left Mr. Banana upstairs. And they're like, you know, Mr. Banana is going to be fine there, and let's just take a little walk. And all right. So they take a stroll. But by the time they come back, the maids have cleaned the room, and Mr. Banana's gone. I love hearing that. It's like, y'all don't even know Mr. Banana. It's like, no, not Mr. Banana. It's because you do know Mr. Banana. It's like, oh, no. And so she goes into the full, like, I mean, it's just like fully screaming, losing her mind. Mr. Banana's gone. And my friend, like, quick calls down. It's like, this is my daughter's stuffed banana. And he said the concierge totally got it. And he said the best phone call he ever got was a little while later. The phone rings, and he picks it up, and it's, Mr. Banana has been found. Pretty soon, come duck, 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 carrying Mr. Banana. The girl, Mr. Banana. And she was able to sleep that night. Now, when you think about it, that's pretty wild. It's a piece of cloth with this stuffing inside, yet it contains not just an image, but an entire personality that everybody else recognizes. And that capacity to use something that isn't alive, to contain something that is alive that we can have a relationship with, is a very old human capacity. And that's the thing I became very interested in when I started writing about images, but especially when I started to be interested in drawing, or what, not drawing, because I like to draw, but what makes people stop drawing? What makes us start drawing, and what makes us stop? And could drawing have some other function, a biological function, that is other than making a nice piece of artwork? And the thing about drawing that it has, and this is what I started to really get interested in, are the original digital devices. Here they are. Wireless, biofueled, you know, like, woo, I can do it. Noah, apps galore. So I started to really get interested in what's happening right now in our culture, with the abandonment of our hands and the abandonment of what almost all of us can do, the original, I mean, an early kind of drawing, which is handwriting. And there are some fascinating studies being done now about, because a handwriting in the state of Wisconsin, cursive or longhand isn't being taught anymore. It's like over. And I was staying with a friend nearby whose mom was the lunch lady at the local school, and she happened to have all the letters from 1974 when her mom retired that all the kids wrote her. You know, Mrs. DeLulo, you made the best. Thanks for saying you liked my hair. And but what was amazing when I was looking at it was by the third grade in 74, the kids were doing cursive. Like, that doesn't exist anymore. So you think, oh, so what? You know, we're just doing we could just do our keyboards. They want to get them on the keyboards right away. Well, one of the interesting things that they found out is that in terms of memory and intuition and realization, that there is something about making a mark. There's all the difference in what's going on in your brain when you make the letter A like that than when you do this to make an A. And you're dealing with spatial relationships. And if you think about it, when people think about their handwriting, oh, I hate my handwriting. It's like, yeah, okay, you hate your handwriting, but what is handwriting? You think it's that stuff that's left on the page, but it's actually a series of physical motions. In the same way I could hand you one of those little, if you're old like me, you can remember there were these inky binky red pencils that Life magazine used to send out. They were like the tiniest, like Barbie pencils that you'd get, and you'd be like, oh God, I have one. And there's no way to sharpen it ever in your life unless you could find like the tiniest. But if I gave you a tiny pencil and a tiny piece of paper, you could write the alphabet. If I gave you a mop and told you to and water and do it on the wall, you could write the alphabet. It's because it's a series of gestures. Actually, there was this really cool article in the Wall Street Journal recently about handwriting and the brain and how important it is for these certain neural connections and memory. But it was in the Wall Street Journal. It was sort of like, I found the secret to cancer, but I can only show it to ants. You know? It's like, all right, Wall Street Journal, those guys are really listening. This is why we must stamp out handwriting. So there are all these studies now about moving the hand, and one of the most interesting ones is we have a part in our brain about this on our left, the left hemisphere here. It's called the Broca area. It has to do with language and meaning. And what they found is that when people are writing by hand, this area is really activated. When they're typing on a keyboard, it's not. There's something about meaning and language and the fact that when I think about, 100,000 years ago when art started to show up and building houses and wearing, lipstick probably was right there, too. It was all around this time that this hand stuff was going on. And so it's really interesting to me, this idea that hand movement and language and memory in the brain are really together. And I know from teaching, particularly in teaching in prison, the inmates had the tiniest handwriting I had ever seen. And I finally asked, what's going on? It's because they didn't want to waste the paper. I was just like blown away. I know you knocked over a 7-Eleven and scared the shit out of somebody, but So that's something that I'm really interested in is what are we giving up when we're giving up handwriting? And what are we giving up when we're giving up drawing? And is there something else that this stuff could be? So we'll look at some slides now. And now I have to move it this way. It's like getting a mammogram. Yeah, see, some of you know. Some of you will never know the joy. All right. So... picture this. It's kind of based on those magazines that some of us remember from kids. They're called Highlights magazines. Do you remember Goofus and Gallant? It's not a great magazine, but I think the reason we're so focused is we often saw them in the dentist's office or the doctor's office. We were like, and so they had this extra, save me. So I found these magazines that were written for grade teachers, grade school teachers, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And the biggest sponsor for those magazines was the coal industry and the asbestos industry. And in fact, every issue had another thing you could make from asbestos as gifts, like necklaces. So I wanted to have my books sponsored by Don't Cigarettes. And so there they are. Smoke Don't. It's the imaginary cigarette with controllable smoke. And it's preferred by imaginary characters everywhere. While you were sleeping, the nearsighted monkey arrives with her imaginary friend. The staring cephalopod invites you to attend. Please attend. Attend to the back of your mind. The nearsighted monkey won't fold. The book was laying on a table at the library. On the cover was a picture of a monkey wearing glasses. The monkey was smoking. She had a pet chicken. The chicken also smoked, but not as much as the monkey. What kind of book was it? While you were out, you had a visitor. She'll call on you again soon. It was an activity book, but the activities were mysterious. Mr. Trunk must find the line that leads to don't. Don't, the imaginary cigarette. Was it a book for kids or grown-ups? The monkey drank beer, played cards, bought lottery tickets. Was that a good influence? Should she check this book out or not? The nearsighted monkey drank all your wine and read all your tabloids again. A perfect day begins with don't. Try one. The line was long and Marlis didn't want to wait. The announcement came on. The library was closing. Arna, man, come on. My show's going to be on. We got to go. Marlis would not wait. Bye, man. Seriously, I'm out the door. So what happens is Arna puts the book down on the library table thinking that she can come back and find it and is never able to find the book again. So this book is kind of her memory of the book. And I just have to say that I owe a great deal of the whole reason I'm standing here has a lot to do with public school teachers and public libraries. And so another big thrill for being here is this library is incredible. And that's another thing that, as you've noticed, it's being tossed out the door, public schools and public libraries. Wall Street Journal loves it. So picture this. This is the winter edition of Picture This. And when I was talking about being in the Jiffy Lube waiting room, that actually, when people say, who's your audience? And I'd say, people waiting in the Jiffy Lube when they're waiting there to get their oil changed and they don't have anything to read and there's an old picture of Tom, like a People magazine with Tom Selleck on the cover. It's like, thank God. I thought that would be my ideal person who's just sitting there with nothing else to do and there's nothing else to look at. And that's who I pictured in my mind. Picture this.
Coloring books are bad for you, Maimon said. They wreck your imagination. Marla says, no, what's bad for you is smoking, man. Maimon says, it's not creative. That was also an idea that happened in the 70s, that coloring books weren't creative. There is this idea, you know, which is crazy, really crazy. And I know that if I was young and somebody gave me a blank book, you know how you do that? You buy blank books for kids. It'd be like, I don't want to wreck it. It's like your journals that you just keep thinking, I'll keep a journal if I spend more money on this one. Till you spend $25 on one with a leather, and then it's going to follow you for the rest of your life because you only wrote 3 pages. It's like you can't throw it away, you can't give it away. It's going to follow you for life. If you use coloring books past the age of 10, you will wreck your imagination forever. Who says? All the scientists. I'm just warning you. Do you recall coloring books? And then there's an ad for don't. It says, wait. You want to color a picture. What a bad idea. Have a don't cigarette instead. The art box. What's in your art box? And so I started out with this idea of just the color blue. And so we collect blue, and we wait while we're drawing, and we draw while we're waiting. And when we get stuck, we move our brush along, and we take it where it likes to go, the certain shapes it likes to make, and the margins will help us. And then that picture over there is the honorable mention for Winter Moment Picture Contest. Give me my mom! Blue. Collect blue. Why not try it? What do you know about blue? And this is the scrap unit. And it says, if you don't have art supplies, don't be sad. A bottle of school glue and a toothpick and paper scraps are all you need for this way of making a picture. Putting one thing together with another thing using paper no one wants to make a person, place, or thing a common noun. Use your scraps of paper to make a noun that can be said no other way. And there's a scrap head. There's some more scrap heads. They're really fun. I hope your fingers are already itching going, hey, Elmer's glue, a toothpick, really? And this is Scrap Town. There's Scrap Winter. And then mosaics. So the scraps were done with torn paper. These are cut edges, so you can kind of get an idea of what's the difference between torn and cut. Which do you prefer? There's some mosaics. I know, and I really hope that you're already going, I can totally do this. I wanted to use stuff that everybody has in their house pretty much already. That's paper bags and, yeah. A chicken in winter. Sometimes in life, when we're very sad, it's good to make a chicken in winter. It's not a beautiful chicken, but it is a chicken that will guard you through the long hours and hours quietly. Sometimes we feel we cannot draw a chicken. So, here is a chicken to use on those days, to copy, trace, cut out, and paste. The dear chicken is on the job. There's this little character in the book named Mr. Trunk, and he says, and there's a character named Van Dyke, and he says, dear Van Dyke, at first I thought the chicken was crappy looking, but then I had my heart broken, and making that crappy chicken was the only thing that made me feel better. Thumbs up to the crappy chicken. There was a time when drawing came easily to us. We liked to scribble, we drew lines on the wall, and we got in trouble for it, and we did it again. Drawing and moving were not separated yet. We liked watching the line come out and stay put. We liked what it did when we shook. We liked making dots. We liked poking holes. We were making a picture that happened because we were just playing around. What's interesting about what happens when we stop drawing, there are a couple things that happen. One is first of all, let's go back to our tacit understanding about what this stuff has to do with the biological function. If you and I are sitting at a table and we have all these markers and we have paper and there's a 4-year-old, a little girl sitting with us, and I say, do you want to draw? And she's freaked out. Wouldn't you worry about her a little emotionally? You know what I mean? You just say, oh, what's wrong with this girl? Now she's 40, freaked out. Oh, yeah, me too, man. It's like, oh, what happened? And why are we worried about a kid who's afraid to draw but not an adult? And when I was, I like to bring my drawing materials and just sort of set it up, and I was at some design conference, and these are like big-ass designers who made, like, I designed the Segway, and I did this and that. And so I had my little drawing stuff set up. I have these Chinese brushes, and I'm just making stuff. And so I hand them the brush. Do you want to try it? They're like, oh, no. And they did laugh. Rose, you try it. No, Bill, you try it. It's like they were all flipped out, you know. It's like, oh, ha, ha, ha. And so I thought, well, here, here's this, it's really easy. You draw a square, and then you divide it in half, and divide those halves in halves, and see how close you can get to the line. And if the lines touch, you get electrocuted. And everybody's like, okay. Like, what happened? I'm too afraid to draw, but if I'm going to get electrocuted, I'm there. It's like, I totally want to do it. So I started to get really interested in why that was. Why was it these people were not going to draw unless it was something that could electrocute them? And part of the thing I realized is that when we're young, really young, a piece of paper is a place for an experience. This is a place where you can get electrocuted or not. Or this is a place. And the other thing is, so it's a place for an experience. And when people are drawing, they're actually, when little kids are drawing, they're usually drawing what the thing is doing. Like if it's a car, it's not just sitting there. It's not usually just the car and drawing all the details. There's some switch that happens starting at about the sixth grade, where instead of drawing what the thing is doing, we draw what it looks like. And then we're able to see that the chair that we're trying to draw doesn't look like the chair out there. But worse, other people are able to see that. And at that point, too, the piece of paper becomes this thing that is good or bad. And I think often about my little brother, Michael, who he would do that thing all these kids do, where you take a piece of paper, you fold it in half, and on one side you draw a line down the middle. And on one side, he would draw an entire stick man army. Everybody's there, you know, the guy with the binoculars, the guy with that hand grenade, you know. He'd draw them all. And then he'd draw the other guys, and he'd have his war ready to go. And then he'd do the thing, what I always tell my students, it's the state of mind when art is going the best, and it's this. You put that in front of you, and then you get a bowl of cereal, and then you eat the cereal really slow and stare at it. You know that cereal trance? Like where everything suddenly is fascinating. Like you read the ingredients and then you read them again. You know what I mean? It's like, dextrose. I'm going to name my first, that's the prettiest name. I'm going to name my baby dextrose. You know, it's like this, that cereal trance. And that is, and talk about a future, past, and meanwhile knob. Like what the hell's going on there? We're suddenly like flour, sugar, like vitamin A. And like you're just reading it going, I'm going to read this like a poem. Flour, sugar, vitamin A. You know how people read poetry? You just want to die, you know? Like, we're having beef, aroni. It's made with mac. So you know it's a poem, right? It's just like the way that you know there's could be comics in something is they'll put graphic in front of it. It's like graphic novel, graphic memoir. Graphic chicken soup for the graphic soul. It's like, there's comics. It's all graphic cookbook. That's all it means, comics inside there. Anyway, so he would go into his cereal trance, and then after he had gone into his trance, he'd start the war. He'd get his, like, red crayon. And the incoming! Ah! You know, and he'd do all the sound effects, and I'd sit in the corner trying not to move because I didn't want to disturb him because I was just mocking him because I was 3 years older. It's like, you fool. You know, and he'd be like, ah, a serpentine, a Medichrome hit, my favorite. Tell my wife I love her. And then when he was done, what did he do with the paper? Nothing. The paper wasn't the thing. The experience was the thing. And if I have, and someday I hope I live long enough to have a portable functional MRI just gun to put on people so I can see what's going on in their brain when they're doing stuff, I would say that there was some huge thing going on in his brain that has a lot to do with our neural network. I mean, one of the things that if you think about our attachment to the arts or our urge to make the arts, this and having an absolute biological function, because this isn't something that I always say when I teach junior high and high school students, are the arts necessary for our survival? It's like, no. I said, okay, what about music? No. I said, what about for you? Is music not? Yes. For me, yeah, I got to listen to my song every morning while I'm getting dressed. But when you think about these things that have followed humans wherever they go, I start to think of them as the corollary to our immune system. In the same way the species survival relies on bodies that stay alive long enough to reproduce, I think we also have to have the feeling life is worth living. And I think that that's part of the function of the arts. I don't think it makes it really worth living. In the same way, doodling, you know how people do, I don't draw anymore. It's like, do you doodle? It's like, yeah. Is there something you doodle all the time? Yeah, I draw my little eye, my eyeballs. Like, you probably all have little things that you doodle in that one little margin. And when I ask people why they think they doodle, if we were doing, again, brain studies, one of the things they know is that voluntary motion actually changes your brain waves. So you're in a meeting and your boss is a jackass and you have to endure it, which is a very old human problem. Ancient days, I'm sure the Neanderthals were like, oh God, not him again, you know. So you doodle. Or you doodle when you're on the phone, waiting for someone to stop talking or come back to the phone. And I always say, I think it changes one's experience of time. Not a whole lot, but just enough. It makes it the difference between time feeling like a cheese grater, and it makes it feel like Brillo. Which is like, you know, it's not that big of a deal to go from a cheese grater to a scrub pad, but you'll have skin a little bit longer and you'll make it through the meeting. And you also won't kill anyone while you're doing that. So there's something that's interesting about drawing, and that's when I think people stop to draw, is when they stop using it for that original biological purpose, and then it becomes this thing of whether it's good or bad. When you're little, you will draw pictures for no reason. Marley says, what you doing? Nothing. Then why are you doing it? Watch TV with me. It's not something that you're good at or bad at. It's something else. I didn't know it's babyish to still like to do this until Marlis made fun of me for it. Arna! You move your hand and you scribble all you want and it feels very good. And I can remember that feeling. Arna, man, come on, it's starting in a sec. No, man, now. But then we saw on TV how Harry Beatniks were making scribble pictures and selling them for $1 million. This is the answer to everything, man. Let's be artists, man. So now we both make them. And when we get 100 done, Marlis says we can buy the universe. Then all we have to do is catch a Harry Beatnik and make him tell us where he sells his pictures. Two smears plus two more and two again. Then three, the same three times. Adding more, try arms up, buttons, shoes, something to stand on, and a hat. And glad to meet you, Mr. Smears. One of my favorite things to do with people who've given up on drawing is we just fold paper so we have this many chambers, and then we just start by doing smears. We'll do an oval smear in all of it, and then we do the eyes in all of it, the nose, the mouth. You do the whole thing so you have 16, and then they'll look at them, and I'll say, which one's drunk? They go, they totally know. That dude's the drunk guy. Like, which one, you know, I was just like, which one's mad? Which one feels bored? And you can find them. There was no planning, but you can find that. I had one of my nephews, I said, could you think of any other questions? And he said, which one feels bloated? I would have never thought of that one. Thaw, leak from the ceiling in our room when the bucket in the attic fills up. Help me move the bed, man. It's getting all wet. Help me push. For 1 month, the world has been frozen, no rain, just ice and snow, and then the change. It's a flood. We need more buckets. And at the door downstairs, my mom and my aunt, home from the cannery and not in the mood for leaks, we sneak some pails upstairs. Oh, my God, my head hurts so bad, I'm ready to saw it off. Do it! The new lights they put in are killing just about everybody. The spreading stain on the ceiling, a shape floating over us at night, a smell of wet wood and plaster. 3 more weeks till spring. Hey, guess what? Your mom's standing in the shower drinking beer from a can, and my mom's in there yelling at her about it. There are shapes that form in shadows and stains. What makes this happen? Why do shapes appear in shadows and stains? See there? It's the boss of everyone, the pirate chicken. Where? By the light fixture. Next car goes by, you'll see the headlights slide over the pirate chicken. I needed my glasses on. Okay, now I'm seeing it. Is there a power that makes them show themselves? Now you, except no monsters. It's got to be something nice. Okay. When I try not to see monsters, they are everywhere. Why has it got to be nice? Because that's the rule. You want to forfeit? When we see the water-stained creatures, are we inventing them, or is the ceiling inventing them? I see Gulita. Oh, stupid Gulita again, man. No, you love Goolita. You invented her. Goolita invented herself. And there, it's like, where do the shapes go when we don't? Okay, I have to just tell you, I was so into making this book. I had just finished my lunch, and I dropped my napkin on the floor. And I saw it, and I was on deadline. I said, just glue it. Glue it to an old, glue it to a page of the phone book. There it is. That's the nearsighted monkey. She hears the girls. And there's a little activity book in called Hullabaloo, Things to Make and Do. It has paper dolls. That was another thing I had when I was a kid, paper dolls that I'm sure people think, you know, this isn't good for kids. But just the thing of having to cut them out and how sad it was when the little face thing wouldn't fit and you couldn't have her have her Easter bonnet on. Marla's paper dolls, Midwestern winter outfit. Let's get dressed and go outside. It's very cold. Long underwear top, two pairs of socks, long underwear bottoms. Brr. It's 22 degrees with a wind chill that makes it feel like -5. Turtleneck, sweatpants, dress, third pair of socks. Please help me get my snowsuit on. Hood, scarf, you cut out the face there. Mittens, boots, bread bags inside boots to keep feet dry are optional. Okay, let's go outside. Except I cannot move, and now I have the sudden urge to pee. Here's another ad for Don't. Color your world with Don't. Creative people don't color, copy, or trace. That's only for people with no imagination. You don't got it, Arna. That's why you color. And this is our essay topic of the week. And this is our question of the week. The nearsighted monkey needs the soap. Will the deer chicken take action? Spring. The nearsighted monkey wants to race ya. The nearsighted monkey orders one hot dog from the vendor. Now, when a few of my friends saw these paintings, they got so happy for me. They was, your drawing's gotten so much better. Like, I can't believe it. Look, just look at the... Oh, Linda, it's amazing. It reminds me of, remember when they would do that extreme makeover? You know, the person was going to get the thing, and they come to a party that they think it's like some party for something, and everybody looks, you're getting plastic surgery, and everybody claps. Wouldn't you be like, I hate you. Like, what do you mean? Your double chin's going to be gone. It's like, shh. So people are excited for me, but because it turns out I'm married to a brilliant watercolorist named Kevin Cavula, and he can draw things that are far away, and I can draw things that are close up. So we found the nearsighted monkey. I was just drawing stuff on the envelope, like, you know, on the kitchen counter, and then I'd come back a while later, and he would have drawn a background in. So we started, actually, I just started drawing a monkey and leaving it on the kitchen counter. We didn't ever talk about it. And a little while later, it would be back with wherever she was. So people are going nuts about, look at that car, it's incredible. And I go, yeah, how about that purse? That's good. Look at those mittens. The nearsighted monkey didn't say she was also bringing her chicken. Now we have two weekend guests. She's a terrible house guest. There she is putting banana pancake mix into the washer. The nearsighted monkey is not careful with the toothpaste. And there's a point for all of us when we kind of realize we can't draw. And my husband Kevin said that he realized he couldn't draw the day he was drew an airplane for his Uncle Joe and handed it to him and said it was a B-52. And his uncle looked at it and said, that's not a B-52. And almost everybody has a story that was like this thing or some rotten art teacher or something happened where we just, something happened and then we didn't, some of us decided to draw anyway, but most of us stopped. What happened on the day I realized I couldn't draw? It happens to almost everyone. The transformation of the paper place for an experience into a paper thing that is good or bad. Shapes divided into pretty or ugly, and the ugly shapes are pushed away into a place on the other side of thought. To keep them there, some of us had to stop drawing completely. Or we had to learn how to draw in an organized way that others could recognize and say yes to. Yes, that's a nice drawing, so you have not wasted time or paper. But I say keep drawing, and if you're lucky and you can remember what drawing used to be to you, you might be able to find your way back to the place where the shapes are happening. Characters and figures. Can you remember not being able to read? I knew about reading before I could read, and I knew about words, and I was learning to write the alphabet. I could pick out certain letters, but they were still pictures to me, and I was drawing them, drawing their picture at school, learning what it took to get the picture right and which lines go where. And somehow, drawing a letter becomes writing it. What's the difference? What changed? If you were to draw the alphabet instead of writing it, what would the difference be, and where would it be? And there's a picture of me when I'm working and I'm in the groove, and then I stop and go, what am I doing? And, you know, WTF. And so the worst thing I can do when I'm stuck is to start thinking and to stop moving my hands. One of the things that's interesting about this in the groove and out of the groove, you see it very early on with kids who go into a state of deep play without even noticing a lot of times that they've gone into it, which is something that I'm really interested in watching. And I was watching this woman having breakfast with her son. She's on her cell phone, and he's eating breakfast. He's probably about 5 or 6. And he's eating, it's bacon and eggs, and he's eating. She's, you know, she doesn't even know where she is. And he picks up this piece of bacon, and he's about to eat it, and he goes, I'm going to eat you. The bacon's like, no! It's like, yes, I'm going to eat you. No! And I'm watching, like, how's this going to come out? You know, it's like, well, who's going to win here? Really engaged. It's like the way he was, like, doing it. And there was some point where his mom turned to him and went, what are you doing? And he had no idea. That's exactly what happens when you're working. It's the same thing. You're in this thing like, I'm going to eat you. You know, like you're doing this thing, and then part of you goes, what are you doing? It's like, I could have been cleaning. You know, you know what I mean? Like there's this idea that once you're out of the groove, you really can't know what's going on there. And I always think about whenever any kind of physical activity, and I think people should know this, that you fall in and out of the groove all the time. I do it all the time. And there'll be times when I'm working and I'll find myself saying to myself, this is really stupid, okay? Okay? This is stupid. This is getting you nowhere. This is idiotic. You really could have been cleaning. You could have been cleaning. You could have a clean house right now instead of doing this. One day I realized that if I was in a bar drawing and some dude walked up to me and said, that's stupid. Where's that going to get you? You know, you could, instead of doing that, you could be cleaning. I know he was an ass, right? I'd be like, you ass, shut up. But when he's in my head, he's the voice of reason. Like, when did that happen? When did that switch happen? Well, that's one of those things that happens as we, deep play happens automatically for kids. But as we get older, we actually have to make a place for that to happen. And we have to know that falling in and out of the groove is part of the deal. Because otherwise, then you think you're doing it wrong or, you know. So, yeah, great, Linda. Doodles. So I started to talk to people about doodles, and I started to collect people's doodles. So I made a doodle cheat sheet. So you can do the amoeba or the fried eggs, the ice cubes. Man, the ice cubes. When everybody, remember when you learned how to make that? God, this is incredible. That stuff still counts. You still can go home and do the ice cube. And like, look at now, if you like squint your eyes, now it looks like it did that. They are olives, not very hard to draw. There's the nearsighted monkey. She says, let's make something. The nearsighted monkey needs 11 more eggs to make a dozen. Her chicken is on the job. And then I made coloring book. And I really encourage people in this book to copy it. Go ahead and take it to the copy place or scan it or color right in the book. So I made coloring book pages. Marlis. Paper bag puppet Marlis. Trailer park Marlis. Dancing Marlis. And then I thought about somebody sitting around at Sears Portrait Marlis. I thought about somebody sitting around their house or at the Jiffy Lube place, or they get home and they think, God, I'd like to draw, but I don't have any art materials. So I just thought, well, what if you didn't have art materials? So I did that with food coloring and 3 Q-tips. So you do have art materials at home. And man, you know what? That food coloring stuff just stays and stays and stays. I decided, well, let me try this. And I would just leave it out in hard sunlight, which is supposed to fade color. Nothing happens to food coloring. It's like those plastic knives and forks they're giving. These are biodegradable. Have you seen those? Like at colleges, it's okay because we're using. So I was at a college and they told me it was a biodegradable fork. So I was really excited. So I took it home. And I thought, okay, biodegrade. So I thought, okay, I'll soak it in water 6 months, nothing happens. I'll put it outside through the winter, nothing happens. And so that's, food coloring. Right. Okay. When you are a guest, you should not leave banana peels on the windowsills. Your host wants the peels in the trash. And you must not say, I will talk about banana peels at a later hour. My show is on. There's another ad for don't. When you're trying to forget, remember, don't remember. Summer. The nearsighted monkey bought more lottery tickets. The nearsighted monkey dislikes the phone. Please use a paintbrush instead. And then I thought about doing a drawing book without a lot of instructions on how to draw, just pictures, so you can kind of figure out how colors work and layering. And you can paint a whole picture if you just have one color. Or just, that's another picture with just one color. Gray. Wait, I like doing this. To psych myself out. No, wait, not, that's not my psych out. That's the psych out. Woo! One good thing PowerPoint's good for. Same thing. So here, you know, my husband who can do things, paint things far away, I said, so how do you do it? He goes, look, paint the stuff that's closest to you one color, the stuff that's kind of far away another color, and then the other one that's far away. And I was like, dang, it works. Summer checklist, we'll skip that. Another ad for don't, and then fall. She smokes don't, but she wishes she didn't. She is smoking more, but enjoying it less. There's a place where characters dwell, and it's not in thinking. Scrooge and Hamlet are there, along with certain toys we played with. Superman and Batman are there. Sherlock Holmes and King Friday and Lassie are there. Eleanor Rigby is there. And when we are gone, perhaps we'll be there too, alive in the image world again and again. I think there is an image world. And what's interesting about it is, when I say Scrooge, you all know who I mean, right? You all know who Scrooge is. We haven't met. You know who Scrooge is. Where is he? Where's Batman? How can we get rid of them? I don't think you can. Can you get rid of Hercules? You know, you can't, man, you can't even get rid of the Michelin Tire Man. I mean, what's interesting is there is this place where they are, and you can add to the image world, but you can't take it away. And again, I really feel like it is our, like our immune system, that human beings developed this other thing, and I think it has to be in response to stress. Here's the best way I can explain it. There's this brilliant neuroscientist named B.S. Ramachandran, who was particularly interested in phantom limb pain. Y'all know what phantom limb pain is, right? You're missing your hand. I always believe that there's phantom limb pleasure, but no one calls the doctor about it, right? Doctor, my missing hand feels fantastic. I mean, no one calls the doctor about it. It's not a problem, really. But Ramachandran had a patient who had a missing hand, but his sensation was not only was his hand there, but it was in this painfully tight fist, which seems like not a big deal. But if you imagine it, it was like his clenched fist, no matter whether he was asleep, awake. And after a while, it really started to deteriorate his feeling that life is worth living. He was really, really getting depressed. And nobody could think of what to do for him. Ramachandran made this mirror box. And the mirror box is really interesting. I had always imagined it as a big shoebox, but I found it on YouTube, actually. You can see the mirror box. So what it is it's a box that has a mirror here, and it has two holes. So what the guy did was, he said, put your hand in one of the holes, and just where he was standing, he saw the reflection of his other hand. He could see it completely reflected. I always do it like this because it makes a little more sense. I imagine the mirror slanted this way. So the guy puts a hand in, he sees the reflection, and then Ramachandran said, open your hand. So he opens his hand, he sees this hand open, and the problem goes away. Just by seeing that reflection. That's what I think images do. I think that in the course of human life, we run up against things emotionally that are impossible. They're like this. A war that happens when you're little, losing a parent when you're little, some horrible bully that you have to deal with at school. There are things that are like this, and that the only way that we can do this is to see it somehow reflected. And whether we're seeing it reflected in a story that, you know, like, or a song, or you know, something that really, really moves us where we, and the, you know, the Greeks called it catharsis. But I think that that's part of what images do. And so when you think about this stuff as being more than decoration and more than elective, what would somebody call, they said that at their elementary school, you're talking about cutting the specials, you know, the special stuff, which is art, you know, music, all these things that it turns out are attached to neural growth and the plasticity of the brain. This is the stuff we're getting rid of. And my book, What It Is, nobody knew how to classify it, and Amazon just took a wild guess and called it science fiction, you know, which I was all about. Like, yes. But if I was going to write a science fiction story about a species that actually was able to methodically convince them to do the thing that would to stop doing the thing that would give them new neural growth, I think it'd be a pretty good science fiction story, and unfortunately we're living it. Okay, so what it is about writing it by hand that makes a different kind of sentence come? Come on, Ben, just say it all at once. I write really fast, you know. One afternoon, I wrote down a story for a 5-year-old who would only tell it to me a word at a time. Yeah, except for you have to write down the whole word down before I can tell you the next one. And he would go, once, upon, come on, man. And in the end, the story he came up with was good. It had a beginning, middle, end. It had everything that we talk about when we talk about story structure. And I said, how'd you just do that? And he goes, I told you it would work. How was he able to make a story up a word at a time and not mess up at all? At that time, I was trying to write a novel, and I wrote my first novel in 10 days. It was a very short novel, and I remember thinking, what are people bitching about? I better not get in this mood very often. There'll be novels all over the house. And The next one took me 10 years. 10 years! Why did it take me 10 years? One, I had read some books about how to write a story. So I knew about story structure and all this stuff. And it never occurred to me that the only reason we know about story structure is because it already exists. It's like thinking the only reason we have teeth is because someone showed us dentures. You know, it's like, you can only write about story structure because it already exists. And then the other thing was that I was trying to write it on a computer, which had a delete button. And also that really, now that I know, there's this whole other interesting thing about when you're using a keyboard, there's a part of language, the language area, that's not stimulated. So finally I gave up, and I was walking around my studio going, okay, if it was me, how would I do this if I was going to write it? If it was me, it's like, who else is it? And this kid, after I did that with him, and he was able to write that story, I thought, God, if this joker can do it, you know, I should be able to do it too. And I thought, what's the slowest? Maybe I'm going too fast. The computer's too fast. What's the slowest way to write a book? Which, you know, frosting would be the slowest way to write a book. But the second slowest is with a paintbrush. So I did. I wrote this book with a paintbrush. And the first thing that I did was I thought about when I was a kid and how I would never write a book without making the book first to write it in. Remember making the construction paper? Like, I even love saying construction paper because people go, like copier paper, construction paper, because construction paper contains an image. So that's one of the pages I did, and I ended up writing a novel that became my novel Cruddy in 9 months using a paintbrush. And then I got really excited, and I thought I had invented it, and I was really going to blow everyone. Repeat the answers here. No one thought of it. It's like, no, 3,000 years of Chinese culture. Turns out they knew about the brush, and. And they knew a lot about the brush and the body and thinking. So again, it comes back to this. There was something about keeping my hand in motion and the fact that when you're doing something by hand, you don't expect it to be the finished thing. The problem with a computer screen would be sort of like, you can have these magic powers, but you can only see the world like on a screen this big. But the problem with this computer screen is as you're typing, it's figuring out all your spatial relationships. It's figuring out how it's supposed to look on the page. It's telling you when you spell something wrong. So what happens is it gives you the illusion that this is a finished thing. And what people are able to do is when they have a doubt about the thing that they're writing, when you fall out of the groove, instead of being able to just wait and doodle and move your hand, people start trying to fix something. You know, they'll read the thing over and start trying to fix something that's not even broken necessarily yet. There it's talking about the brush. Oh, wait, here it is. It took a long time to realize that I didn't need to be in the mood to move my brush before I picked it up. All I needed to do was move the brush, and my mood would follow the trail. This was big news to me after years of doing a weekly comic strip. I was rarely in the mood to draw. I never drew for fun anymore, and I would have had a hard time saying what drawing for fun even meant. I had characters in the way, in the strip, but I never drew them unless I was on deadline. Dang it, I'm on deadline, don't talk to me. It's like no one's in the room. And when I did draw them, I was usually stressed and irritated. I hated my drawing, and my drawing hated me right back. And I believe it could have stayed that way had the brush and disaster not come into my life. Who does war belong to? Who does natural disaster belong to? Who does death belong to? This is my mother. She grew up in the Philippines. I hate that sound. And there's me. How come? You ask too many questions. You know that? You talk too much. My mother was a kid in a village just outside of Manila when the bombing raids began on December 7th, 1941. And this is my husband's painting of the bombing of the Philippines. It's on a piece of notebook paper. I just let some notebook paper, and I wrote a note. Can you draw the bombing of the Philippines? And yes. And then there's the rabbit's a character in the book. What happens to the unspeakable? What happens to the unthinkable? And then these were these things that all happened at once: Iraq, Afghanistan, Katrina, and then I had a series of friends who all died right around in a small amount of time. My response to a series of well-known disasters and the unexpected deaths of several friends was a confusing compulsion to paint cute animal pictures, in particular the meditating monkey. First drawn while crying in an airport bar en route to a funeral, I found it helped, and I drew it again and again. I've since painted hundreds more, maybe thousands. There's always a path that is lost. My mother found comfort in coloring books after the war, even as a young adult. She was balanced when she was hand coloring, not happy, not sad, free of that. Color crayons and hand motions over pictures of cute animals made a way for her. Is making a picture and coloring a picture something other than art? What is the difference between drawing and singing? In terrible times, people sing. Things can be said no other way. Mourners sing, and music makes a way. It's not a way out, but a way in. Where do you go when you color? Where can a brush take you? It can take you to the singing place. Here's some of my monkeys. Bats. And there she is waiting for you. Broken branches. This is at the end of the book. It's called a branch library, and they are small compared to the main one, which is too far to walk to. Dang, see, I told you, the sign says. Closed as of August 31st. Please return books to the main library. Weird to see it so empty, like it's always been that way. No trace of Granny or Mrs. Kedso or anybody library-ish. There's only a plant in the window, and it's dying. Oh, man, another case of window plant tragedy. The librarian was talking about it when I last went in, how all the branches were cut, and her and Mrs. Kedso saying things were drying up. Pardon my French, but those bleeps have their heads up their bleeps. Those cockabamy bleeps are sucking us dry. They're bleeping vampires is all they are. And you know they won't let Granny into the main. And then we realize Granny's her dog. There's no one to say goodbye to but the figurine stuck in the planter, still reading a book like nothing had changed. Goodbye, you stupid elf, says Marlis. And then she asks me why I'm crying. And then here's Hullabaloo, the sketchbook. You know, being at this library, the thing I said earlier about public libraries and public schools, I mean it with all my heart. They really did save my life. And it's painful to see this stuff that is so vital to human beings being figured out how to just get rid of it. Get rid of handwriting. Get rid of all this stuff. Let's focus on testing. It's really painful. So this is what the drawings look like when I left them on the kitchen table for my husband or on the counter. Sometimes they look like that. I do a little color indication, and then that's what they look like when I get them back. How about that coat? And we would have these fights. Like, I swear to God, he put the scarf on the chicken, and he thinks I did it, you know, and we still don't know who did it. There's a letter in your mailbox, and when you see it, you say, oh, no. But the nearsighted monkey is coming to visit. She is on her way now. There she is reading her book. So I'm going to tell you a couple of little other stories, and then I'll let you go. Let's see. One I want to tell you about drawing. If you hold my work in any kind of esteem, I'm about to change that immediately by telling you my absolute favorite comic strip is Family Circus. How much do I have to pay to get out of here? But I love family circus. I grew up in a very violent, difficult family. I always say blood and hair on the walls, at least to this high. And when I would open the paper when I was little and I'd look in that circle and I'd see Jeffy and Dolly and PJ, you know, and Billy, and then Mom, on Saturday, Mom would give Billy, go mail this. And then we'd follow him, like how he had to go through the tire swing and all this. Every once in a while, the dead grandparents would be looking down from heaven going, you go, Billy, you're so good. I love that strip so much. I just love the peace in it. And you know that thing when you're a kid, you'll hear stuff like, an opera singer can hit a certain note and it will blow up a glass. Remember you'd hear that? You'd be in the kitchen with your milk mug going, or you'd hear, when you see beautiful art, you'll burst into tears. Remember hearing that? And you'd want to. And I always wanted to burst into tears with a cute guy, like, nearby. So he'd go, she is so sensitive, I must have her. And so I traveled around Europe by myself when I was 26. You know, I went on a trip by myself. You know, people will say that. I traveled through Europe like this. I don't know what I'm doing. I know you can't go into a restaurant. But the one thing I could do was go to museums, and I'd go and I'd try to burst into tears. You know, I'd look at pictures and go. And so I'm in the Uffizi Gallery and looking at this Botticelli, and sure enough, cute guy at 9 o'clock, you know, a cute guy here. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to burst into tears. Like, I'm really trying. And I was able to get one tear, but it was the wrong side of my face. So I was like, it didn't happen. And so, and he didn't fall in love, and I came home. So years later, I'm a cartoonist, and then they start to invite alternative cartoonists to where the main cartoonists are. So I go to this big festival, and it's everybody, you know, it's like the guy who drew Beetle Bailey's walking by. Like, everybody's, what, the person who does Lockhorns, you know, Wizard of Id, everybody's walking by. Then I see Kathy. And I get so mad. I almost tackled her because she's really thin and beautiful. Like, slender, nothing like Kathy. I think, you've been making your living off of women with asses like mine. You know, give me some of your money. And you earned it illegally. And so she goes by, and the person who drew Family Circus was Bill Keane. In a lot of cartoonist families, they often pass it to the son or the daughter if they want to keep drawing. So now who draws it is Jeff Keane, Jeffy from the strip. So one of my friends goes, oh, Linda, you like Family Circus? And I said, yeah. He said, this is Jeff Keane. And I went, ah! I mean, like, I was drooling. There was snot. I was shaking. I was moving toward him. And this has never happened. Dude's like, this has never, ever happened. And I was like, ah, ah. And I actually said, excuse me. And I went behind a potted plant like no one else. Just get it together. It's like, I know. Okay, I'll get it together. And then I went out and tried to talk to him again. Same thing. Ah. And the joke of the whole festival was to try to get him in my line of sight because I couldn't. And I burst into tears, but I realized that when I shook his hand, I had come through the circle, that little circle that I looked through the whole time I was a kid. And the way I did it was by drawing a picture. And when I think of this stuff, images, as being not just an immune system, but a transit system, the whole reason I'm here today in Philadelphia at the Great Philadelphia Library is because I drew a picture. And the whole reason you guys are here is because you're interested in images, or you want to make out with somebody who's interested in images and they got you to come tonight, which is the same thing. And then I want to tell you one more story, and I just want to talk a little bit about this idea about editing. Because again, remember when I said that we know about story structure? I mean, story structure's there in us. This idea about editing and writing things over, or drawing something over and getting it right. I always say I wish we could stop editing. Like, every time you're walking down the street and you're behind somebody and you say to yourself, if I had that ass, I would not wear those pants. That's editing, right? You know, if you just cut your hair, it would be. So, And if you think about what editing's about, the biological function of editing, I think it has something to do with making us feel better. If you've ever had the experience of being in it, so you go into a store, it's a groovy music store, and you go and you know, there's a cool guy sitting there who's like behind the counter, and you're my age, and you go and you put your Jonas Brothers CD down, and he looks at you and makes some comment, you know, and then you feel small. And so you take your CD and you go back to the car, and suddenly you realize what you could have said. You know what I'm talking about? And what do? You don't go, oh, I wish I had said that. It's like, no, don't you start the scene. You're driving home, but you start the scene again. Now you're walking back in. There he is. Pick up the Jonas. Put it there. He says this, but then you say that, and he goes, oh. And then you feel a little better driving. I feel a little better. So what do? Don't you play it again? I mean, in fact, we'll do it. We'll run through the scene and edit it so much so that by the time we get home and we tell our friends that's what we did say, you're not really lying. That's what I call autobiofictionalography, right? And I think the function of that was to make yourself better. It's a response to stress. But if what you're doing is you actually have made a scene that you could say daylight, interior, record store, you know? I mean, you've actually done the whole thing with the dialogue. So I have this scene I want to tell you about that I've been editing, since I was 21 years old. And it was a time when I was really concerned about my femininity, if I had enough of it. You know, like, Linda's a girl, kinda. And so I thought, God, I gotta be more feminine. How can I do it? It's like, oh, they had just invented skincare system. I need a skincare system. That'll do it. But I knew I'll go get a skincare system. Clinique had just been invented. And so I thought, oh, I know. But I knew I'd have to like go into the store and I'd have to see those ladies, you know, who are wearing white and they're kind of behind glass. They're kind of like butchers in a way, you know, like behind it, like the glass cases. But you're the meat. And they make me very nervous, those ladies, you know. So I did whatever I do when I get really nervous, which is eat a hot dog really fast. And there was a hot dog stand near the department store that had bratwurst. If you're from the Midwest, it's like, bratwurst is fantastic. This was in Seattle, you know. It's like, it's in the foreign food section in Seattle. It's got bratwurst. And it had dill relish. Oh, I love dill relish. Sweet relish, no good. You can throw it at vampires. That's the only use. But dill relish. So I pile it on. I eat the hot dog. And then I go face the lady. So I face her, and I'm brave at first, but then she starts, and at the time, this is in 70-something, she's talking about, she calls it a computer. It was just this little piece of plastic that moves around, and no matter what she does, you have to spend $100. And so she's like giving me all these things. She puts it in the bag. It's time to pay, and I'm just demoralized. And, of course, I'm wearing an army surplus jacket, right, you know. And I have my wallet in here, a little flap. So I go in to pull out my wallet, and as I pull it out, like this teaspoon of dill relish falls onto the glass counter, right? And we're both like, what could, you know, we're both horrified. And I'm looking at it, and she's looking at it. And then she recovers first. She takes her Kleenex box, goes like that. Let's put it in there, pay it. And I walk out. I've been editing this for since I was 21, and I'm 55 now. And these are my two favorite edits. One, do this, pull it out, relish. That's one, and the other is it's a relish. How you like me now? How you like me now, Clinique lady? So when you think of the when you think of this stuff as having this function that has this biological function, and that art is so much more than, you know, whether you're groovy or not, then it becomes more interesting. And so I always end with a party trick. Some of you have seen me do this before, so you know to turn away. I can sing without moving my lips at all, and I will do it for you, even though it takes a year off my life every time I do it, because it'll take a year off of yours, too, and you won't know. Okay. Okay, so here I go. And this is a song from the image part of me to the image part of you. And I mean it with all my heart. When I said shine, I only said shine. Be happy, let's play together.
much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. I'll see you later. And I love Philadelphia with all my heart.
There's only one. Give us about 5 minutes and we'll meet you upstairs. Thank you.